Radio Moscow. This is CBS in New York.
This is Radio Moscow.
Hello, Moscow. CBS New York calling.
Hello, CBS New York. Hello, CBS.
CBS Radio presents Radio Beat, a special report on educational aims in the Soviet Union and in the United States. Today, for the first time, you will hear distinguished American educators talking freely and extemporaneously by radio with their opposite numbers in Moscow. You will hear in this unique transatlantic conversation unrehearsed questions and unrehearsed answers. And here to begin is our moderator, Dwight Cook.
We believe in the broadcast you're about to hear that one of the rare firsts of this year is coming about, because for the first time, so far as we know, in the history of radio, you're going to hear an actual unrehearsed discussion between a group of educators sitting in a studio in Moscow, Russia, and another group of educators sitting around a table with me here in CBS New York. Our discussion is going to be on the purpose of education. And here in New York with me are the presidents of three American universities: Dr. Carol Newsom, the president of New York University; Dr. Barnaby Keeney, the president of Brown University; and Dr. Gaylord Harnwell, the president of the University of Pennsylvania. In Moscow are three Russian educators: Dr. Ivan Petrovsky, the rector of Moscow University; Dr. Michael Chalikin, the director of the Moscow Institute of Power Engineering; and Dr. Peter Polukin, head of the Department of Mining in the Ministry of Higher Education of the USSR. With the three men in the studio in Radio Moscow is Mr. Joe Adamov, who will translate, because our three guests in Moscow all speak Russian, none of them speak English. Therefore, comments will be made here. Mr. Adamov will translate them into Russian. The Russians will answer in their own language, and he will translate back for us. Therefore, all the answers which you hear in English will be in the same voice, but they will be the translated, direct, unrehearsed reactions of these men in a studio in Radio Moscow. Now we'll direct ourselves towards our guests in Moscow.
As we sit around the table here in CBS New York, Mr. Adamov, all of my guests are interested in what would be the first area of curiosity which your panel in Moscow would like to raise. Have you a question you would like to have our men answer?
Mr. Cook, I see that Professor Polukin of the Institute of Steel would like to start the ball rolling.
Я хотел бы поставить моим коллегам личные вопросы относительно определения способностей лиц, которые поступают в университеты.
Professor Polukin says he would like to ask a question about how you determine the intelligence of students that want to enter universities in the States. We know that the entrance exams in the States are carried on in written form, and there is no personal contact between the student that wants to enter the university and the professor at the college or university, whatever it might be. Therefore, I think that the system of oral entrance examinations is better than the system of written entrance examinations. What do you think? What do our colleagues across the Atlantic think?
All right, Mr. Adamov, two or three of my guests have their fingers up. Dr. Keeney of Brown University was the first one to indicate, so we will let him start. Dr. Keeney.
Well, Professor Polukin, we use, first of all, the student's secondary school record, and we take that more seriously, I think, than anything else. We use an objective test of aptitudes and, to some extent, of accomplishments, which is nationally administered. Not all colleges use that. We take that second most seriously. Sometimes we use intelligence tests, which are administered in the schools, to determine whether or not a student is achieving above or below the natural level of his ability. We take very seriously the recommendations of the people in the schools, and at Brown, at any rate, almost every student who comes to us has been interviewed either at the university or in his own home.
Mr. Adamov, there's a question which Dr. Keeney was interested in directing at any one of your panel. Dr. Keeney?
Yes, Mr. Keeney.
I gather that you do not use intelligence tests to select your students. How do you then tell which student is able and not performing up to his capacity?
Mr. Polukin will answer that.
При отборе студентов для поступления в университеты наши,
when we select students for our universities,
мы проводим конкурсные экзамены.
We have competitive examinations, entrance examinations.
Ответы студентов на экзаменах являются основанием для определения способностей и талантливости.
And the answers that the students give at these entrance exams, we judge their talents, their intelligence quota according to that. And we also glean quite a lot from the marks that the student got in high school. Professor Chimikin.
Меня интересует такой вопрос. Он, вероятно, должен интересовать и вас.
This is what I'm interested in. I suppose you're interested in the same thing.
В большой мере результат, который можно получить в высшей школе, зависит от результатов, полученных прежде.
The results which can be obtained in college depend to a great extent on the results obtained previously, that is, in high school. And especially in our age of physics, the preparation which our student gets in physics in high school prepares him well for his further studies in college and university. From those entering our universities and colleges, we demand the knowledge of physical laws, of an ability to make practical use of the knowledge that they have. They have to know how X-rays are applied in medicine, in technology, in the testing of various materials, and they also have to know the microscopic testing and microscopic analysis of various bodies.
Придаете ли вы также большое значение подготовке по физике именно в средней школе?
Do you pay as much attention to the training in physics in the high school as we do?
All right, at this end, Dr. Newsom of New York University wishes to answer.
Mr. Chalikin, I think there may be some basic difference as I listen to your question between our high schools and yours. Our high schools are usually described as general high schools. That is, we have a considerable program in science. Many of our students spend time every year studying some kind of science. But in addition, Mr. Chalikin, we have courses in foreign language and foreign culture. We have courses in literature, courses in history and sociology, quite a breadth of background. So on the high school level, it is not common for our students to really start extreme specialization. Now, boys who show considerable interest in science come out of our high schools with considerable knowledge of the basic materials of science. Now, they do have some experience in X-rays, in the theory of the atom, and that kind of thing. But I'd like to emphasize that the real screening process for advanced study takes place after high school rather than before. We are very much interested in the high school, upon the high school level, that our students receive a rather broad background so that they will have experience with many fields of knowledge, after which they will decide which one they'd like to specialize in. I wonder if this will help Dr. Chalikin understand our present situation.
Thank you. Wants to give and does give our students a wide background in all fields. Physics does not have any dominating role in our secondary school. But you see, you could teach a subject on the modern level, that is, on today's level of science, and you could teach physics on the level in which it was taught, say, 10 years ago. I hope you agree with me that it is easier to teach physics the way it was taught 10 years ago. But it would be, of course, better, I hope you will agree with me, to raise the teaching of physics in secondary schools to a modern, contemporary level. We do not give any priority to physics, don't understand us that way. But we think in the little time that is devoted to physics, physics ought to be taught on a modern basis, on a modern level of science. Do you have any other point of view?
We had a rather different point of view, Mr. Damoff, not directly connected with physics, but all of us here in New York were interested in your guests' reactions to the very general question, What is the purpose of an education? Why do you educate a man in Russia, and how do you know you have succeeded?
And how do we what?
Know you have succeeded. How do you test the success of your education? This, at a very broad level, reflects the interest of all of the gentlemen here in New York.
Professor Chilikin again. Who am I answering?
You're answering all of us, Mr. Damoff. All of the gentlemen here have had the same question in their minds. And
Mr. Chilikin asked the question, who was he answering? And I will tell him that he's answering everybody.
Through a communal voice.
For that,
what
does that mean?
Well, then, Mr. Newsom, Mr. Keenan, Mr. Harnwell, I think we will all agree that the aims of education are indeed humane. We expect from those who graduate college a wide knowledge and a wide spiritual knowledge in all fields. This is very important for us because only a short while ago, our country was a country of illiteracy. So when I speak about of the aims of education, I am speaking personally. I'm giving my point of view. But I see that my two colleagues agree with me. The aim of education, as I understand it, is to raise the general culture of the people. And, of course, when education encompasses not tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, but figures much larger than that, that means that we want to raise the cultural level, the education level of the people as a whole. And when we speak of the aims of education in this country, we must always keep in mind and very closely connect this with the great numbers of people that have to be educated. Judging by our press, we have solved the quantitative problem because there are something like 50 million people studying in this country, undergoing education in all its forms. Which means that every fourth person, counting the aged and the infants, is studying. And therefore, when we speak of higher education, be it technical or be it of the humanities, we want to raise and to educate the spiritual forces of our students. Professor Tillichan says he thinks it harmonizes and in no way conflicts with the government. This merges with the aims of the government and with the people.
I should like to ask Rector Petrovsky the question. First, though, I should observe that the number of people, or the percentage of the population studying in Russia, is almost identical with the percentage that is studying in this country. My question is this. Clearly, education is of benefit to the individual who is being educated. Clearly, it's also of benefit to the society in which he lives. Which would you put first in importance?
Я считаю, что первое, прежде всего, имеет значение образование для индивидуума.
Rector Petrovsky says that he thinks that primary importance, education, is significant for the individual. But the education of each individual does good to other people, too. And therefore, to the people at large.
You are to be congratulated. This is Mr. Harnwell of the University of Pennsylvania on the growth of your educational system. And we wonder whether in its growth you have had trouble finding the proper teachers for your students.
Rector Petrovsky. No, we never had any difficulty in finding the required teaching staff.
How do you select your teachers?
Teaching vacancies are usually filled according to a competitive system. Every teacher, every professor is picked on a competitive basis for a period of 5 years.
Do you select your best students to be your teachers?
I wanted to mention this. We are very much helped by the postgraduate courses that we have. It is from the postgraduate courses that we get most of our teaching staff and also the scientific workers. So you see, the postgraduate courses of the universities and colleges, they are the source that supplies us with our teaching staff and the scientists.
I have one more question. How do you select, then, the people that go into your postgraduate courses? Are these the best students from your regular college curricula?
Yes, these are the best students. We watch over the students. We watch the way they study for a period of 5 years, and that enables us, of course, to easily pick the best.
Do people voluntarily choose to be teachers rather than to be scientists or to enter into some other activity?
Yes, that's the word. Dr. Pestrovsky says, yes, of course, they choose voluntarily.
Mr. Damoff, this is Mr. Cook with a general question connected with this. Who decides what courses are available for students to take or for teachers to teach to students?
Rector Petrovsky. By the faculty council. The curriculum is decided by the teachers' council. Allow me to dwell a bit more in detail on this question. In the first year of our studies, the education is extended and is wide in scope. If, for instance, we are preparing and training a mathematician, on the first course he studies physics, foreign languages, then the humanities and social sciences. The curriculum of the first year of studies is decided upon by the so-called Learned Council of the university. And in the fourth and fifth years, every student is attached, so to say, to a professor or a professor's assistant. And the student consults the professor who is supervising his studies, and together with him he decides what subjects he ought to pick.
Dr. Keeney has a question connected.
Just 1 minute, please.
Yes.
You had another part to the question, I think. Does the student voluntarily pick the subjects he wants to study? You mean, does he voluntarily pick the university or college where he wants to go? Is that what you meant?
No, I was raising the more general area of who decided what courses were available for a student to pick or a teacher to teach.
I'm trying to elucidate this problem.
Now, do you have a course
The first year has a curriculum which is, as I've said, is decided upon by the council of the faculty. And on the higher courses, that is the fourth and the fifth, the student himself chooses the subject, having his scientific consultant and his head of the chair. And that is where he works on his thesis.
Dr. Keeney.
This is Keeney. I gather, on the contrary, that there is a very considerable uniformity in the curricula of schools with a similar purpose, running from the primary school through the technical institute, even into the university, and that the curriculum is prescribed by the Ministry of Education, and that there are quotas for students to be admitted to each school, that many are not able to be admitted to the school they choose. I should like to hear one of you comment on this point of view.
Rector Petrovsky of Moscow University. I spoke of the curriculum already and of the teaching plans. As for the entrance of students into the various faculties, the number of students that can be accepted is determined by our planning organization. This plan is drawn up and is based on the requirements of the culture in this country and of our national economy in general. But after having been accepted into this or that faculty, the student voluntarily and freely chooses the specialty which he wants to follow. He himself picks his own scientific leader, his own scientific consultant.
Is the planning done
just
by...
Just a minute, please. I see that Professor Palukin has raised his finger. He wants to answer that, too. Professor Palukin says, I'd just like to add a few words to what Rector Petrovsky has just said.
У нас имеется некоторый обязательный минимум дисциплин, который должен изучить студент в высшем учебном заведении, как это имеет место в Соединенных Штатах.
We have a certain minimum of compulsory subjects that a student has to take at a university, just as you have. But then every institution of higher learning has its individual curriculum and study plan. Of course, the field for wider choice of studies and of fields that the person wants to pursue is given to a postgraduate student. There, he's free to choose any branch or field that he wishes. They get their own specialty, their own course, their own professor. So the field for free choice of the branch that he wants to follow is actually unlimited.
Dr. Harnwell had a...
Excuse me, Professor Palukin hasn't finished yet. Я хотел перейти к вопросу следующему. Хотел бы задать нашим коллегам. Professor Palukin says he has a question which he would like to ask his colleagues. Mr. Cook, how do we work this? Who's first?
Well, why don't we stay with this planning question, which the gentlemen around this table were very interested in, and then go on to the question that he has, if that meets with your approval in Moscow?
Agreed.
All right, Dr. Harnwell had another area of this planning which interested him.
This is Harnwell of Pennsylvania. My question related to whether the planning was done by the individual university, like the University of Moscow, or whether it was done by a State Department of Education.
Rector Petrovsky says that the planning is done student. You mean the plan of acceptance of students, the number of students to be accepted onto various faculties, is that what you mean?
Yes.
The quota, the number of students to be accepted into institutions of higher learning, is usually given by the Ministry of Education and by the various planning organizations. And I see Professor Palukin wants to add something to that.
Здесь нужно внести некоторое уточнение.
He wants to add a little correction here.
Планирование приема в высшее учебное заведение осуществляется только лишь в отношении дневной подготовки.
We plan the number of day students, that is, the students actually studying at the university, not the correspondence students. As you probably know, we have a wide network of correspondence students and so-called evening colleges. And here, as far as the so-called evening study colleges are concerned, and the correspondence courses, here there's no planning at all. We accept all who wish to study. And Professor Chalikin wants to add something else, too. I would like to ask Mr. Harnwell, what are the principles of planning in the United States?
Before Dr. Harnwell answers that, Dr. Newsom here also wanted to get in on the earlier discussion, and then Dr. Harnwell will certainly go on. But may Dr. Newsom ask his question in the same related area before we switch back to your questions?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Newsom.
Well, this is Mr. Newsom of New York University. I must confess that I'm a little curious in regard to the planning function, and I'm asking this as a question that interests me very much because I think it is quite significant in any society. How do you plan to meet the needs of the total society? That is, your society is very complex, as is ours. So how do you meet the needs of all of that society? That is, providing adequate medical care, experts in the various social sciences, experts in the business field, experts in art, literature, poets, and so on. How do you weigh these various elements in your planning?
The question is clear, Professor Newsom. Rector Petrovsky has raised his finger.
Я не знаю, как планировать нужную подготовку поэтов.
I do not know how to plan the... to plan the training of poets is impossible. He says he thinks that it is even impossible to train a poet. But I think we can calculate the number of teachers to be trained. Professor Palukin.
Вопрос планирования подготовки специалистов высшего образования — это действительно очень сложный вопрос.
I quite agree with you that the problem of planning the number of specialists to be trained in this or that field is a very complicated problem. But you see, the fact that all of our economy is planned makes it easier for us to plan this part of our economy, too. If we know the plan of the development of society as a whole and of our economy as a whole, it is easier to calculate and to plan culture and education. We, of course, cannot vouch for the fact that we are very accurate in our planning of specialists, but we can sort of approach a level which would satisfy us. In other words, we cannot never vouch for being perfect in that field, but the fact that society is planned and the fact that our economy is planned makes it easier for us to plan, say, such a field as education. But, of course, we cannot, with the accuracy of a drugstore attendant, weigh or determine the exact number of people that we need in this or that field.
Если наши отклонения будут в пределах 25% в ту или другую сторону, мы считаем, что мы успешны в своей задаче.
And Professor Palukin says that if we calculate the number of specialists we need in this or that field to, say, if we're out by 25% this or that way in the number of specialists that we need, we think we're good.
All right, gentlemen, you wanted to ask a question or two back. You were very courteous in waiting and let us continue examining this field. Do you want to pick up where you left off with a question, Mr. Adamov?
Yes, Professor Chalikin wanted to ask a question, Mr. Cook.
так же, как и вас, нас интересуют эти вопросы, вопросы планирования.
We are just as interested in this question of planning just as much as you are, gentlemen.
Я хотел бы задать профессору Хорнуэллу вопрос относительно того, как в Америке так поставлено это планирование.
Professor Chinnikin says, I'm interested, and I'd like to ask Dr. Harnwell how the problem of planning stands in the United States.
Dr. Harnwell, well, on a broad national level, we don't have a system of planning. There is a system of supply and demand for various participants in society. Of course, in universities, we must plan, because no one university can teach all subjects. Our universities in general are not big enough, with maybe the exception of that of Mr. Newsom. We have to choose specialties like medicine, law, or dentistry. Of course, all of our universities have the general undergraduate curriculum, but we make no attempt to plan who will take various subjects in this curriculum. This is chosen by the students, and they do this on the basis of what they think they would like to study, or what they think the demand of society will be for their services.
Professor
Chinnikin says, don't you have a certain disproportion in that case between the demands of society and the supply, so to say, of the students?
Yes, I am afraid that we often do. We would like to have more teachers now, but we do not have as many teachers as we wish. On the other hand, the lack of teachers is making the teaching profession more attractive so that more people will now go into teaching.
And Dr. Newsom had a point he wished to add here.
This point that I wanted to make may not be in direct reply to your last question, but I wanted to supplement my colleague's original reply by saying that we operate on the assumption in this country that if we encourage each individual student to develop his own talents to the best of his ability, that the broad needs of our society will be taken care of. We put considerable emphasis, therefore, upon seeking the individual capacities of each person. We believe that if one boy shows up with considerable medical talent, we should encourage him to go in that direction. If he has a pronounced interest in physics, we should encourage him to go in that direction. And we believe then that our total needs of our society will be taken care of by encouraging the development of each individual. Now, I might continue by saying that it is true that upon occasions, some professions have more recruits. But then we find that boys have a tendency to veer in another direction where those same talents become useful. So we find that the supply and demand factor works amazingly well, possibly within the 25% factor that you named originally.
And Dr. Keeney has an additional comment.
I'd like first to make an observation and then ask two questions. I think there's a fundamental difference in our educational systems. Our basic education is in the liberal arts and sciences, which is designed to prepare a man's mind to move around in the world and to move from one occupation to the other, if he decides to. I have had six occupations, for example. Therefore, if a man goes into a field which is overcrowded, he can move fairly freely. Even our engineering programs in a place like Brown are really programs in applied science of a rather basic sort, so that a man who starts out to be an aeronautical engineer can perfectly well move into civil engineering or vice versa. Now, the two questions I have are these. Suppose that the graduate student in your university selects a field where there are already more students and practitioners than the plan calls for. What happens to him? The second question, what do you do when a graduate of one of your specialized schools, after a rather exact and specialized curriculum, has to move from his specialty to an allied specialty?
Professor Palukin.
Вот при рассмотрении этого вопроса нам кажется, не надо смешивать две вещи.
We think we must not confuse two things here. One is the question of the aims of education. Just as you are interested that the student develop his talents, his abilities to the widest possible degree and to the fullest possible degree. We offer such opportunities in an unlimited way. But we do not want the various tendencies and the various likes and dislikes of the individuals. We would not like to see them bring us or society to an absurd point.
Если бы вдруг все наши юноши и девушки захотели быть юристами, то мы оказались бы в бедственном просто положении. Мы не смогли бы решить многих инженерных задач, в том числе и запустить спутник.
For instance, if all our boys and girls wanted to become lawyers, we would just be in a fix. We would not be able, for instance, to launch the Sputnik. I'm answering the question asked by our colleague. If a boy or girl was unable to enter this or that faculty because the faculty was already full up or he did not get the number of points required at the entrance examinations, that does not mean that he cannot get an education in his chosen field. That means he can get an education, but maybe on conditions which are not as favorable. Those, as I've said, who study during the daytime at our colleges and universities, the tuition is free and they get a scholarship or a stipend. They still have an opportunity to, and they can easily get a job and study in their spare time or study in the evenings. Of course, they will not be getting a scholarship in that case. If a person wants to acquire an education, he's always sure to achieve the aim that he's placed before himself. And when we speak of planning the number of students we want to enter this or that faculty, we usually have in mind the material side of things, because they have to be provided for when they study in the day courses. If you want to study under conditions that are more favorable, that is, without working, and at the same time get a scholarship or a stipend, you have to be above the average, so to say. You have to pass the entrance exams and enter the day courses. But that does not exclude you or does not bar you from studying at our evening courses or correspondent courses. Rector Petrovsky.
Я понял вопрос профессора так. Он спрашивал, что делать тому окончившему университет, если он по специальности не может получить работу.
Did I understand the professor to ask me that what is a person supposed to do if after graduating he cannot get a job in his picked speciality? I have, Rector Petrovsky says, I have never met such a case yet, because the demand has always been greater than the supply, that if I can call it a supply, of students, that is the number of students graduating this or that speciality. Both Professor Palukin and Chalikin want to speak at the same time. Well, we'll say... Professor Chalikin says, I'm sorry I didn't answer that part of your question, I just forgot it. Professor Palukin, I'm sorry.
Не будет беды, если по каким-либо обстоятельствам инженер или человек, окончивший университет, не получит работу по той специальности, по которой он получил образование.
Professor Palukin says there's nothing wrong if a person doesn't get a job in the narrow specialty which he picked and which he graduated. We very often in life meet people who have graduated one faculty or have trained themselves for one calling or speciality and are working in a totally different field. And this is possible because we give a very wide and very extensive theoretical and extensive practical background. And this allows us, a graduate, to sort of switch over from one profession to another in life.
There's a lot of champing at the bit at this end, Mr. Adamoff. Everyone wants to get in on this discussion when he may.
There's Professor Chalikin at this end that wants to say something, too, but we'll be the gentleman and let you have the floor.
Dr. Newsom.
I would merely like to make a comment in spite of the fact that your society is a planned society, whereas ours is not. I'm interested in the fact that we have been getting along very well in having no surpluses in the various professions. As I have been sitting here thinking, I can only comprehend one profession that I would regard as actually being somewhat crowded at the present time. That is, I think in a dynamic system, it's going to be possible for boys and girls to obtain positions in the field of specialization or in some related field. So we have had rather amazing success, perhaps, by the standards of my colleagues across the ocean in placing people in our professions. That is, we have not reached any type of haphazard condition whatsoever in the education of people. So I like to make that merely as a comment that might interest the three gentlemen there in Moscow.
Mr. Damov, I would like to suggest a question which I am simultaneously asking of my guests here to see if the colleagues in Moscow would agree to answer it too. Sometimes in a frank discussion, one gets at facts or differences by a negative comment. Perhaps if...
Would you please repeat that?
Yes, sometimes one gets at understanding via a negative comment. I am going to suggest that both the men here and the men at your end answer the same question. The question I would ask is, what do your men think is the greatest weakness as they understand it in the American educational system, and simultaneously then, what do the men here think as they understand it to be the greatest weakness in your educational system?
Okay.
Well, since it's a rude question, why don't we continue being rude at this end and make our comment first, if you please?
All right, go ahead.
All right, gentlemen, they have just heard this question, so they're in the same position as the men in Moscow. Who of you gentlemen would like to start phrasing our conception of what we feel is the greatest weakness in the Russian system? Dr. Keeney, do you want to start?
I base these remarks on some writings by Soviet educators and not on any preconceptions of my own. I have read recently an article by a very distinguished Soviet educator who complains that students discuss things they have not troubled to learn, that educators are not always eager to discuss...
Could you repeat that, sir? I didn't quite get you.
Yes. He complains that students sometimes discuss things that they have not troubled to learn before they discuss them, that teachers are not always eager to...
And the students discuss things which what?
Which they do not understand.
Oh, they discuss things which they do not understand.
Right. That teachers are not always eager to discuss things with students which the students should be brought to understand, that students don't always appreciate what they're being given at the expense of other people, and that students lack initiative in their work. Now, this man goes on to attribute some of these weaknesses, particularly the lack of independence, to teaching by rote, dogmatism on the part of the instructors, and a certain lack of general culture among the specialists. I might say that the first complaints, that is, down to the lack of initiative in the work of the students, has often been made by American educators about American students.
Well, Dr. Keeney, would you rephrase here a second? What then do you feel, from your information, is the greatest weakness in the Russian educational system?
I should say lack of initiative on the part of the students in pursuing independent work.
Dr. Harnwell, have you an addition in here? We might as well round off our side of this. Dr. Harnwell is passing. Dr. Newsom?
Well, I must go back to our discussion of a few minutes ago in which we were talking about the planning function. It seems to me that this planning function might lead to possible misconceptions and perhaps actual abuses. In other words, one segment of your society might be unduly influential, and this might determine the direction of your educational efforts in an undue fashion. Any type of planned educational quotas and so on is so contrary to my own experience that I must confess that it's a matter of some concern, because I can see possibilities of what I would regard as misdirection for the good of your total society.
Mr. Damov, I wonder if your guests in Moscow would not like to answer these comments as they see fit.
All right, then we will first answer your question, gentlemen. Professor Lukin will begin. I would first like to remark on the last question, since I participated in this discussion on planning. We do not want to convince anybody, or we do not want anybody to follow our system or our actions.
Нам планирование нравится, и не только нравится, а мы считаем это непреложной необходимостью.
We like planning, and we not only like it, we think it's a necessity, it's a vital necessity. And we are not afraid of the things which you may think wrong in our system. We are very confident in this business of planning, because the planning is done not by a narrow group of people, as you may think, but by a very wide group of scientists, of educators, and you may even say by the people themselves. How are our plans drawn up? Firstly, there are suggestions made by various enterprises, factories, plants, and so on. These suggestions and demands are worked and checked and filed according to various fields of endeavor. When the various fields of endeavor, the various branches of industry, make their suggestions to the Republican educational organs. All the suggestions made by the various Soviet republics are gathered and scientifically analyzed. This is very complicated work. It requires much analysis, much thought, and is very complex indeed. It is not thousands of specialists, of research workers that take part in this, but tens of thousands of people actually participate in this work of drawing up the plans. And our plans, you could say, are the final results of the wishes, of the demands, of the needs of the whole nation at large.
We thank you for that extended answer.
Excuse me, Mr. Cook.
Yes.
Rector Petrovsky, we would like to add something. I would like to speak on the initiative of the students. Every professor at every college, every institute, should be concerned in developing to the full the initiative and the abilities of the students in his charge. And every professor may not be satisfied with the results of his endeavors in his field. When I explain to you and describe to you our system, which is applied in the fourth and fifth years of our colleges and universities, I think you should have understood that there is every possibility to develop your talent, your ability, and to follow any line that a student wants to when he's already in his fourth and fifth year. And if you want to know how the students make use of this ability and this opportunity, I can quote the following example as proof of the freedom that the student enjoys in his fourth and fifth years. For instance, last year, the students of the mechanical and mathematical faculty of our university printed 20 articles in the papers published by the Academy of Sciences of the Soviet Union. And to be very objective on this question, I personally, to be frank with you, am satisfied with the results achieved by our students.
Mr. Adamov, may I interrupt a moment?
Yes, please.
In fairness to you, you have very thoroughly answered the point we raised. We would like to do the same in return with the time we have left and try to answer whatever point is in your mind.
Yes, all right then. Mr. Cook, Professor Chilikin wants to answer. I'll try to be as brief as possible, he says. He thinks that free competition at entrance exams in Soviet colleges is a great force. And I think a weak point is when you select people or people have the ability to enter college in your country according to the well-being of the family or to the money that the family may have, and also according to the racial point of view. That is a weak spot in your educational system. That is, the monetary backing of his family as being a factor which determines his chance of entering a college. That's point one. And the second point is the racial point. Professor Chilikin says that according to your system, where money plays a role and race too, and if that determines a person's chances of entering college, he thinks that is one of your weak points.
All right. Every finger is raised on
this. Every finger is raised at this end, too. Professor Publican. In my opinion, the weakness of the educational system in the United States is that you have a break between theory and practice. I think that people who get the bachelor's degree and after going through a four-year course in your universities are not very well prepared, are not prepared for practical activity well enough. Yeah. And they're always faced with the problem, what part in life they can play. And to be quite frank with you, we do not envy the students in your country who are faced with such a problem. And Professor Petrovsky, I would like to ask our transatlantic colleagues. Rector Petrovsky says, how do you intend to correct your mistakes and how do you intend to further develop the educational system in the United States? I learned that there was reform of education in the offing. You plan to sort of reform the educational system in your country. What do you intend to do?
There are so many fingers up in the air that they'll have to come down one by one. Which of you gentlemen wants to start on what could be fairly called a barrage? Dr. Newsom?
I appreciate the opportunity of starting an answer to this question. It has many parts, so I will take only one part, and I'm going to try to answer by reference to my own particular university. I happen to represent one of the very large universities in the United States with some 38,000 students. You'll be interested in knowing that in my student body, I have over 2,000 students from abroad. They come from all the countries of the world, Africa, Asia, and what have you. From this country, we have students from every state in the Union. As you walk across the campus of New York University, you see Orientals.
May I interrupt you, sir? I see that Professor and Academician Petrovsky has raised not only a finger, but his whole hand. He just wants to put in a word.
I request to ask Academician Petrovsky, Petrovsky, Kalinik, or Professor Badmini,
Academician, how would you answer this question of exchange of students and exchange of professors between our two countries? I'm very interested in that, says Academician Petrovsky.
If I may continue, and then we'll come back to your last question. Is that satisfactory?
All right, sir.
I was telling about New York University and the composition of our student body. I wanted to emphasize that we have in our student body every race, every creed, every color. It's a most heterogeneous group. In fact, during the summertime, I have discovered that we actually have a sizable percentage of Negro students. Of course, in the wintertime, we likewise have many hundred Negro students. When you refer to the racial problem, I presume you refer to one or two isolated incidents in one part of the United States, which we all regret. But at the same time, I would like to emphasize that the universities represented here this morning, and certainly most of the universities of the country, there'd be very few that would not be able to make a reply very similar to my own.
And Dr. Harnwell wants to get in on this point of racial discrimination, too.
Yes, my university was founded by Benjamin Franklin, whom you may remember, and we have never had any discrimination on race or color or creed. Many students from all over the world come to our campus as well, and they live together in houses in order that they may become better acquainted with one another. This, we think, is very helpful indeed in begetting understanding. Most of these students we have to bring over on fellowships and scholarships, which we call the same thing which you call a stipend. We pay these boys or girls whatever is necessary for them to come and for them to live when they are here with us.
Keeney, as for money, we practice a maxim at Brown, which may be familiar to you. It is from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. Our students are selected without any reference to their financial ability or their wealth, and we balance the budget of those students whom we wish to have with us by scholarships, by loans, and by jobs.
This is Newsom again. I think it's only fair to say that in the United States at the present time, virtually no boys or girls are kept out of college on financial grounds. There are so many stipends and other types of financial assistance available that it would be certainly a most unusual case if a boy or girl were kept out on financial grounds.
On the matter of practice and theory in our universities, we find that there is no lack of employment for our graduates. We have a department in our university which assists our graduates in finding work. They find work which is to their liking and generally directly in accordance with the things which have interested them while they were undergraduates. Of course, to a certain extent, all of university work is theory. On the other hand, in the sciences and in engineering, much practical usage is learned.
I want to make another comment in regard to the financial element. We have represented around the table three presidents representing private institutions, but I want you to realize that the great majority of students in the United States go to public institutions where there is virtually no charge at all. The latest figure that I saw on that is that 57% now of the students go to public institutions and 43 to private. Of course, we in the private institutions, likewise, as my colleague Mr. Keeney has said, do not make wealth a criterion at all.
That was Dr. Newsom, and Dr. Keeney also wants to add to this point.
You might like to know that both Newsom and I attended publicly supported institutions, though we now preside over privately supported institutions.
And Mr. Adamoff, since there were a good many questions from your end involved in there, if there are any principal question which you think we have not answered, and if you just repeat the gist of it for us, we would be delighted to attempt to answer it immediately.
President Petrovsky would first of all like to get an answer in what direction do you intend to reform your educational system, because he's heard that you intend to make some reforms in your educational system. That's point one. And then what do you think of Rector Petrovsky's suggestion of an exchange of students and professors between our two countries?
Right. We'll take the reform first. I suspect we're always trying to reform our system, and let's see what the experts say.
This is Harnwell of Pennsylvania. We're never happy with our system, but I do not know of any particular reform that is at present contemplated. We are looking forward to a very large increase in enrollment because the birth rate was great 20 years ago, and this is posing many problems to us in getting adequate teachers and in making adequate provision for these students.
This is Newsom again. The public has always been encouraged in the United States to make comments about our educational system. You'll find throughout our history that there have been frequent periods when there have been criticisms as well as favorable comments. But this does not necessarily reflect the view of educators. Right now, there has been a lot of comment on the part of certain members of the public. But I know of no reform that my institution plans.
Well, the main reform that we all plan is to make our education better. May I speak now on the question of exchange?
Yes, if you will. Dr. Keeney again.
We would very much welcome an exchange, both of students and faculty at Brown. Actually, we've had some of your people on our campus during the last year or so at Learned Society meetings. We learned quite a lot from them, and I think they from us. But they were here very briefly. We would like to have them for a full year. Several of our faculty have visited Russia in the last 2 years. We would like to have them stay in an academic institution for at least a year.
At our institution, Pennsylvania, we do have a learned archaeologist from Russia, and one of our archaeologists is spending a year with you. We would like very much to have this grow.
I can merely second what these other two gentlemen have said. We have had several of our professors in Russia in the last few months, and they have found the experience most informative and interesting. I would like to see this encouraged. I think we're all in agreement upon that matter.
And Mr. Adamov, since our time is almost up, may I cut in here to say how much we've been interested in this frank discussion back and forth with the technical problems, the language problems, and even in spite of your great help as a translator here, perhaps we've not achieved the fullest results of this kind of a technique, but certainly at our end, if we have omitted saying something or making clear a point, it has been accidental, and we much appreciate the opportunity to talk frankly and extemporaneously with you in Moscow.
Mr. Chilikin wants to answer, Mr. Cook.
Я полагаю, что эта приятная беседа имеет и несколько больше предыдущие последствия.
I'm sure that our conversation, our free discussion, has far-reaching consequences. I hope it will bring together and work and make for a better understanding between the peoples of the United States and the Soviet Union. Till we meet again, gentlemen. And Rector Petrovsky says our greetings to you, gentlemen. Professor Palukin, we'd like our colleagues to understand us correctly. We do not consider our system of education perfect by any means. We know that we have our shortcomings, and that is why we are studying the experience of various countries. And in parting, I would like to also express the wish for wider contact between our institutions of higher learning. Till we meet again, gentlemen.
I think we all echo those sentiments. Thank you again, and goodbye, Radio Moscow.
You've been listening to Radio Beat, a special two-way discussion, completely free and unrehearsed, between American educators in New York and Russian educators in Moscow. The American participants were Dr. Carol V. Newsom, president of New York University, Dr. Barnaby C. Keeney, president of Brown University, and Dr. Gaylord P. Harnwell, president of the University of Pennsylvania. The Russian participants were Ivan Petrovsky, rector of Moscow University, Mikhail Chalikin, director of the Moscow Institute of Power Engineering, and Peter Polyukin, head of the Department of Mining, Metallurgical, and Building Sciences in the Soviet Ministry of Higher Education. Our moderator was Dwight Cook, and the Russian replies were translated by Joe Adamov of Radio Moscow. This has been another broadcast in the public interest of the kind that only a network can provide, and only a station affiliated with the CBS Radio Network can bring you. Radio Beat was produced by George Vikas, supervised by Ralph Backlund. This was a presentation of CBS News.
This is the CBS Radio Network.